This is HBR episode 2156 entitled HBR Community News for October 2016 and is part of the series HBR Community News. It is hosted by HBR volunteers and is about 77 minutes long. The summary is HBR Community News for October 2016.
This episode of HBR is brought to you by anhonesthost.com. Get 15% discount on all shared hosting with the offer code HPR15. That's HPR15. Better web hosting that's honest and fair at anhonesthost.com.
Hi everybody, my name is Ken Fallon and you're listening to another episode of Hacker Public Radio Community News for October 2016. For those of you new to Hacker Public Radio, we're a community broadcast network, podcast network, where the shows are crowdsourced from the community. This show is a once a month review of what's been going on the previous month, and you're very welcome to join us. Joining me tonight is Dave Morris. Hi Dave.
Hi there. I just wanted to say that tonight is November the 5th. I didn't remember until I suddenly heard a bang outside. So this is the British evening where people go mad and let off fireworks. So there may be a few noises off.
Nearly a problem. No problem whatsoever. And I still need to fix the Gravatar HPR logo, which I tried to do in fairness, but I got, at the time, the admin email isn't working. So I couldn't reset the password in order to get in, blah, 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 blah.
That's a shame. Yeah.
Anyway, it's on the list. Josh is going to move us over to a new server, and that should fix some of the background issues which we're having at the minute with the admin email address. It does work. If you send stuff to admin@hpr, it does get to us, but you do get a bounce back saying the mail has not been delivered, which is not true. It has been delivered. In addition to that, I was thinking of changing the admin mailing list name, Dave, to janitors@HPR in order to better reflect our function here. We are not in any way, I think the word admin conjures up a level of authority that actually we do not possess. So janitor@HPR would be a better thing.
I think that, yes. You should have a mop and bucket logo somewhere along the line, I think.
Excellent. In fact, just one of the things this month was that the Twitter feed service that we were using to redirect our website to Twitter went away, and it'll come up in the news. And so I registered on LinkedIn that as a Henry Patrick Riley, our good friend and colleague living over there in the States, has set up a lot of social media presences and has graciously allowed us to use his name for these services. So he is down as a janitor as part of the network on LinkedIn.
I like that. Very nice.
Anyways, so you want to welcome our new host? It's an easy one this month, but if I do it this month, then I'll have to do it next month. So you better do it.
Okay. So this month's new host is The Bishop.
Excellent. Excellent name. And welcome to the show. So the first show was HPR Community News for September, oddly enough, as it happened. And we did not have any comments on that, Dave. We need to say more controversial stuff, I'm afraid, every month.
We've been trying to do that, but obviously not need to try harder, I think.
Or perhaps people are spending more time doing deliberate responses and uploading them as a show, which is absolutely fine by me. So the first real show of the month was the Gloom tabletop game, which is was reviewed by Tlatu. And I think since he's moved to New Zealand, he's doesn't appear to have as much internet access, so is relying on a lot more board games and is doing a lot of board games reviews, which I think now merits a series by itself, actually.
I agree. It's on my to-do list, but I was going to contact you about it, but yeah, we'll get that sorted.
So the gloom is a sad and benighted place. The sky is grey, the tea is cold, and new tragedy lies around every corridor. Debt, disease, heartache. Not exactly the most uplifting of games, I would have thought, but it's pretty cool. Didn't know it existed. This is the one where they had the plastic see-through cards. I must say, I've never seen it myself.
No, I don't know anything about these things, but that sounds amusingly unpleasant.
They're it seems to be a thing that people are doing now. Don't know if it's this new hipster culture. Get out of my lawn. But I know quite a few guys in work are into gaming. So nice.
Yeah. I think I said my daughter's a student, and she's very very heavily into, you know, all sorts of tabletop games with her pals. So it does seem to be a trend.
Yes, cool. There was quite a bit of that in college, but I never Dungeons and Dragons and that sort of thing, but never had the patience to get into it. Also a bit concerned that if I did, I wouldn't, you know, it would be a dark road. I wouldn't be able to make my way back from, you know, become addicted to games.
Yes. I think that's probably true.
Okay, in the Bishop's first show was an introduction to data reduction methods, run length encoding, compression technology, part one. Could this be a series? I really hope it is.
I think so. Well, it's down as part one, so I'm hoping there are going to be many more of these. Very interesting.
I think we can safely say he owes us a show. If you promise a show, then you owe a show, wouldn't you say? But actually, this one was very, very well explained, the whole concept of encoding and data reduction, and with a rather nice example as well. So I just remember getting off the train going, that was a fascinating episode. I didn't even notice my commute.
Yeah. I was quite absorbed by it as well, I have to say. It was, I sort of had picked up a few hints around this area, but really hadn't, you know how you do, and hadn't quite joined them together. I can see this as joining all the disparate bits together in my head in due course. So looking forward to more.
Absolutely. Cool. So the following day we had Tlatu.
There was a comment.
Yes, there was. Go. You read it.
So it was from RTSN, who said, good episode. I just wanted to say, it said sat, but never mind. It's hard to correct typos in this comment system. I wanted to say that I really enjoyed this episode. I love the light technical episodes with a good balance between hand wavy explanations and preciseness. It gets me interested, I think he meant, and makes me want to learn more. So keep it up.
Excellent. Thank you very much. And Dave, you must remember that not all people's first language is English, and spelling mistakes do happen, especially if the comments are done on a mobile phone. So
absolutely.
Cut us some slack, Dave.
I did a lot of proofreading in one job, and once you get into that mindset, it's really, really, really hard to get your head out of it again.
I don't think I could not proofread. Well, I proof listen, do a lot of text to speech, especially for long specifications that we get in work. I'll just kind of have them on the screen and just listen to them, and I could read something 15 times and miss it and just hear the mispronunciation or spell something missing when it's done in via text to speech. Sorry, I'm rambling.
That's very cool.
Anyway, Tlatu demonstrates how sequence systemd shutdown systemd. And you know, I've been using systemd now for about a year and a half, and I really was between two minds about it. I'm familiar with Solaris having something like this, and that I can understand that it's necessary, but I think it is the greatest pile of crud that has ever been introduced. It is just, I've had a problem, right, where systemd, where I unmounted my proc file system and I couldn't mount my proc file system because systemd prevented me from doing it. And then it wouldn't allow me to do anything more because systemd was running. So it prevented me from mounting it. It prevented me from unmounting it. It was a greatest pile of doo-doo. I had to get somebody to go down to the server room and physically reboot the server that I did this on. Whereas another system, you'd just be able to proc or do an init one, and then you'd switch to, you do rebooting, nothing worked. And because there was no logs, cause systemd clobbered the log file system. It was just a mess. Just overly complicated and just a mess. And this episode here shows that it's a mess, that you need to put in a dummy service in order to get it to run. Sorry, I just think it's overkill.
Yeah. I haven't had many dealings with it. The only one I got caught by was because I had a lot of NFS mount points. So I use NFS for sharing files around the house. Mm-hmm. Systemd didn't like the way I did my NFS mount, so I had to redo them, and it took a while to work out what it was that systemd wanted. This was a year or 18 months ago, maybe. Yeah. I've got notes of how to fix it, but I can't remember the details now. But other than that, I have heard people saying that some operating systems are trying to do away with cron because systemd will do the job.
I'll tell you, no, if that happens, I'm just going to not use those systems. It's a mess.
I couldn't quite see how systemd could run cron, but run the equivalent of cron, and why the hell you'd need to, throw away something that's been tried and tested for so long and replace it with something else, I don't know.
Yep. No, I don't. I think there are people who get it and like this monolithic approach to everything, but no, I don't. I've given it, 2 years of service, and I was on the fence about it, but now I'm just, this is really enough. Anyway, enough about that. Let's move on to the next show. Thanks, Klaatu, for doing this, because, what would have been a relatively simple, make a script, do a symlink, before you now have to do fake services and all the rest. And I get the need for services, yes, I do, but it doesn't have to take over your system.
Now, the service type interface is quite nice in many ways, but yeah, I think I probably agree with you.
Okay, and if you don't agree with us, then feel free to leave a comment and to this episode, or better yet, do some shows about why we're wrong. Anyway, the following day, you did Stole My Software with your audio speed.
You got a credit.
Yes.
A credit.
That's all you want, yes. CC by SA. And yes, nice. I think I might actually... But did you have the script? Of course you did. Of course you did.
Yes. Yes, it's in the... It's attached to the show, and it's in the links at the bottom.
Yeah, there's...
And it's also on GitHub, I should say.
Oh, cool. There's the YouTube player now that also supports Spring playing faster, as does the Firefox media player.
All right. I knew about YouTube, but I didn't know about Firefox. That's quite useful.
If you right-click on, if you go to the website of HBR, for instance, and you right-click on any of the play widgets that we have there, and then you have play speed, slow motion, normal speed, high speed 1.5, and ludicrous speed 2.x. So pretty cool.
Very, very good. Yes.
But needless to say, nice episode. And if you're not speeding up your podcasts, then you're not listening to enough podcasts. So we had Klaatu reviewing the card game A Pirate Flux. And he has links to the game.
Yeah, it's another card game that I don't know anything about. I keep telling myself I must find out more about these things, and because I have a certain reluctance to get into these things, I'm not really sure why. But I should push myself a bit.
You need friends. That's the problem, Dave.
Oh, thanks, Ken.
Yeah, no worries. This is Flux Card Game, and it's the one where you can change the rules as you're playing along. And there was one comment from John. Flux Synchronicity. Amazing Flux Synchronicity. I purchased Flux Firefly Card Game about a month ago. I agree with how the game is set up. Is good, but you can burn through cards fast. It's fun to get started, and they have a lot of different Flux games, but the concept is the same across all of them. Again, love the card game perspective.
Yeah.
So, very good. The next day, pause all things Sega Genesis. Learn how to create hardware, pause Switch with the Sega Genesis from Sigflop. Did you have a Sega Genesis, David?
No, I didn't. No, I was never into gaming machines. I had a BBC Micro, which did all I wanted to do gaming wise.
So with this, I was strangely, there was one thing in it where she said one way electricity, and I was going, what is? And she, the microcontroller, correction to the episode, the microcontroller would have to watch the vertical sync. So she misspoke about that. And in the diagrams on the website, it shows you the controller M1 with the out pin, which is pin 11, and M2, which is pin 10, 11. Don't know what pin it is marked there. And then you have the IO card, which is A2. And the one way, I was a bit confused about that it needed to be a one-way system between the switch, so she had a diode in place which actually made clarify that. So
yes, it took me a while to differentiate between arrows and diodes there for a second, but
yeah,
that's just me being thick.
No, I'm just learning the symbols and stuff, not having done electronics and wanting to do my ham radio. Yes, folks, I'm still chugging along with that, but I keep getting distracted because it's very, very interesting. And but yes, watching Big Clive videos really does help for that. And Great Scott, actually, as well.
Yes. Big Clive is definitely a channel you should watch if you're into electronics.
Regardless, like the way, if you're not, if you want to find out ways of killing yourself.
Yes. And making things blow up. The ones that say with flames on the end are like, you know, setting fire to a room. Yeah, you know, one of these things that sprays scented stuff in the room. You put a flame to it to show what would happen.
I like the travel adapters that are, you know, you plug them in and all the other prongs are completely live as well. You know?
Anyway,
enough about that. I'll be talking about that next month. Or actually the month after, perhaps. I've done a soldering episode and I just threw that up there. So we've got Hack the Box with Bandit. And my bill talks about the Linux war game called Bandit. And if anyone who hasn't used this, it is excellent. It's an excellent game. I'm in the process of doing it myself. And although I keep forgetting to go back and finish it off because I get stuck and then I forget about it. And then somebody else tells me about it and then I do it, play it again. And so it is, but it's excellent. The challenge of the game is just doing proper old Unix commands and little tips and tricks that you are going to come across if you're dealing with files and permissions and stuff. So that's pretty cool.
Yeah, I haven't looked at this yet. It sounded really good. And NY Bill sounded very enthusiastic about it. So I must have a shot. My son's quite keen on getting more into Linux and stuff. So maybe point him in that direction.
And I've tried not to look at each website, each page that you go to has got some clues for the next one. And I try not to use those. And sometimes I've gotten the answer, but not with the clues that they've used. And then I go back and look at the clues and go, right. Oh, okay. Well, that would have been a lot easier. Why didn't I do that? So, very nice.
Yeah, great way to learn.
So, Crayon, do you want to read this one? We're going to have to. Thanks for the episode. I always love these little games. This one is indeed focused on beginners, but can still be a bit fun. I only just started trying it out, so I'm up to level 16. Haven't come across any challenges yet except the constant password typing. I've created an extremely over-engineered little basher C2E's typing bit with it. Once you've got the password, you simply type SSH next and then paste the password. It copies each level to ensure only people of your level can screw with your stuff and to give you a working directory if you need one. One need only as bandit 0 choose a base name for the directories, change me here, and create a directory temp change me bandit 0 on the file temp change me underscore bandit 0 dot bashrc containing. And there's a script which does, what is he doing, creates a rot 13 tr alias. This makes great radio now, me trying to figure out a bash script.
I was going to skip that if I was reading this one and say, you really need to go look at this.
I think Crayon should actually do a show explaining his bash script here, because I would like this one.
Because this ROT13 is quite a nice idea. He's shifting the alphabet by rotating it by that number of characters, 13 characters, I guess. Which is very neat using TR. So, yeah, yes, so there's a lot to mine in there. This.
Yes, there is, yes. Crayon, come on, get your finger out, dude. So yes. The next day we had Clinton Roy from org mode to LaTeX Beamer to PDF. And this was about, basically org mode from in Emacs to LaTeX Beamer to PDF, which is just what it says, explaining how one would do this. I am not an Emacs person, Dave.
Strangely enough, neither am I.
However, Plat2 is.
Yeah, yeah. I used to work with a guy who was very much into Emacs, and he was always saying, you should learn org mode, it's brilliant. And I say, yeah, but I'm trying to learn Vim just now, so I'll give it a miss.
But he still was right, trying to learn Vim.
You never stop.
So do you want to read Plat2's comment?
Yes. Plat2 says, cool. Wow, this is really slick. I'm going to have to give it a try, or at least something close to it. I know nothing of LaTeX, or LaTeX, as people like to call it. So I might skip that part. Thanks for the show. So, yeah. The LaTeX thing has enormous power for making very cool-looking documents and slides and everything. It's definitely something to be in if you can, I think, but I used to use it all the time, but I've forgotten everything about it now.
I think we have a standing request for people to do some shows on it, because I must say that any of the documents that I've ever seen produced with it are just a level of quality, you know, just very classic, well-produced documents. And even though word processing has come on, you can still look at a LaTeX document and think, wow, that's done in LaTeX, because it's far better than anything else I've seen up until then.
Well, it's also programmable. That's one of the things I liked. I had the task of writing a document at work years and years ago, and I used Tech, in fact, because I could write my own little macros in it to enable me to do cool stuff in it, you know. So a typesetting language that's also a language. What could be more cool than that?
Yes. Yeah. So the following day we had your good friend Be Easy, Vim plugins I use. In this episode, I talk about Vim plugins as I drive home from work. Very glad he did. And but be careful, hands on the wheel, eyes on the road. So some of the plugins, Dave, have you you've commented on this show? Do you want to? I thought there were actually quite a lot of them that I will I would like to try out myself.
Yeah, I do use a number of them. I don't use Pathogen for managing plugins. I use something else whose name I've forgotten just now, but I use a lot of the plugins here. But there were a few I hadn't used and have gone and researched and installed in some cases. So this is a really good get you started type of set of things, actually. The things he was saying about them are well worth listening to get a good idea of how you could use some of these and why you would want to. I think it's Surround, for example, that contains the capability to, if you select a word, you can do capital S, and then type in, you know, quotes and stuff. But it also lets you put HTML tags around things.
Yes.
I think that's the one.
It's very impressive, yeah.
That is wonderful. It's absolutely brilliant. I use that all the time.
Cool. I still use Kate, but just what I use. Do you want to read your comments or shall I?
Oh, yeah, I'll read it if you like. So I said, very interesting show. Great episode. I find you can always learn something from a fellow Vim user's list of plugins. There were several here I hadn't used before, though I'm trying them now. You mentioned an ACK plugin, but it wasn't on the list in your notes. Did you mean, and then I gave a URL of an ACK thingy, or is there another one you use? Because ACK is the tool, I think he mentioned himself a while recently, which is a sort of grep replacement, written in Perl, I believe. And so it's actually got some potential for use in Vim. So I'd like to know which one is recommended.
So that's cool. The following day, Klaatu, make web Python with Flask, which is a Python-based web micro framework, which is all the rage right now. And we had quite a few comments on that. So short, fat, bald guy. I don't know if that's a descriptive or whatever. Great podcast, Klaatu. Thanks. Your episodes are always solid, and this one gave me 10 new things to go and explore. It may have helped that it lined up with something I'm currently playing with, home automation and a tool for my wife's co-workers. So that makes it much better for me. Thanks, Scott.
And Jonathan Culp said, no thanks, zero thanks for introducing yet another tool I'd like to learn but have no time. Maybe next vacation, smiley face. And then he comes back with another comment, which I just add on to this one, saying, seriously though, fantastic show, man. I'm very intrigued by this thing.
Beezy says, give Bottle a try. Great episode. If you like Flask, you may want to also try out Bottle for smaller projects. Or if you just want to make a REST API, they're very similar calls like app.root, and its default templating engine is pretty similar to Jenga 2. You can use Jenga 2 if you wish with Bottle as well. Klaatu replies.
Klaatu says, cheers. Glad the app is appreciated. As I say in the show, the only reason I ended up using Flask was because it's what we had installed at the day job. Bottle, Web2Py, and Django are all other similar projects which I probably should have mentioned in the show notes so people can click on links and read up on each to see what they're interested in. Either way, it's pretty fun to mess around with and a great way to stay immersed in Python if that's what you already know or are busy learning and or perfecting. So very cool. I haven't looked at this one properly yet. I did have a need to use web framework when I was working some years ago now, and I used a Perl one called Catalyst, which was horrendously complicated. And it's for another MVC web framework thing. Yeah. I got it to work, but I'd like to look at these sort of guys to see if they're, you know, a lot more straightforward to use. I think the world has moved a fair bit in the past 5 or 6 years. So
yeah, very cool. That's true. Okay, the following day we had some book reviews by Mirror Shade and two books people may find of interest. The first being Hacker Culture by Douglas Thomas, and the other is A History of Modern Computing by Paul E. Kurzesi. Do you want to correct those names, number one, and have you read either of these?
I would pronounce the second chap's name as Ceruzzi, perhaps? Ceruzzi? But no, I haven't read either of these. They look pretty good, actually. Yeah, I seem to have had a rather busy month, so I haven't delved into these yet. Normally, I go and follow up links and check them out. I haven't done so yet, but I will do. I will do.
Yeah, it's always interesting to get links to some books and stuff on book reviews. So continue sending those in.
Yeah, it's a good show. It's a lovely show format. I would certainly appreciate more personally.
Yep, and the following day we had GNU Oc Part 3, making it an official series. So this is a, in this episode, Advanced Topics of the Oc Tool. Oc is a text manipulation language. It comes in various forms called Oc, Noc, Muck, and Gok, but the standard version is GNU Oc Gok. It's a programming language optimized for the manipulation of delimited text. So we do replace grep, logical operators, using the next command, which is excellent, and the end command, which I've used but never understood what it was about, the begin command, which I have used and never understood what it was about, and now I do. Thank you very much, guys.
Yes, yeah, great show, great show. It's, so, yes, I
should be...
How
are you two divvying these out? Did he...
Well, we're sort of just sort of playing it by ear. I'm trying to map it out a little bit more clearly, you know, saying, well, maybe we should do this chunk next, and deciding who's going to do it. Because at the moment, what's happened is BEEZY's done some quite nice, you know, here's some stuff you can do with Orc. And then I've come in as the boring bugger who then talks about, ah, well, the syntax of this is that. And, you know, I'm wearing my anorak, which probably American listeners don't get. But, you know, the so, but it's...
Well, it's a nice type of combination of both. It's working well.
Well,
whatever you're doing is working well.
Yeah. Okay. Well, the next episode's going to be doing just that very thing, actually. It's going to be drilling down into some of the concepts here and talking about them in a bit more detail.
Also, the show notes are playing along. So this one you might want to read the show notes for, just as a by the by.
We're going to try and make some PDFs or EPUBs or something from each of the notes. I haven't got around to doing them on... The previous shows yet, but the next one coming up has got notes with it. But the problem is getting a really good format that uses that, you know, doesn't mangle up the text, because they all have their idiosyncrasies
exactly,
as to how they represent things. So, but that's what we would like to do.
I'm getting a bit worried as well about that. Well, producing ebooks is something that's going to be in my future very shortly. Well, not very shortly. Whenever my wife is finishing a book. Just, I think I mentioned it here before. My wife is writing a book on autism, which is going to be released under Creative Commons license. And she's going to give it away basically under CC by SA. And we'll try and get her printed as well. But so as part of that, I need to convert it to ebook formats. So I'm interested in this whole publishing thing and stuff like that.
I'm sure there's a lot of advice available out there if you search. One of our hosts has written a book using Markdown, and I'm not quite sure what the back end was, but to produce an ebook which you can buy on Amazon. That's McNallow.
McNallow
is
Andrew
Cormack.
Yeah, because yeah. I was thinking when you were saying that, Lost in Bronx has also done that.
Yes, oh. I'm sure there are many more that we maybe don't know about.
Well, why hasn't McNallow done a show about it?
Yeah, we should talk to him about it.
Anyway, Bambeaker says, I cobbled together what I learned from part two. Maybe there's an easier way. And Vim, and he's expanding out a shell with grep-ri double quotes TPL header asterisk, piping that into awk with a minus f quotes colon quote print $1 quote close expansion. So if I'm not correct, he's grepping everything for TPL headers. He's using a colon as a delimiter and printing the first header and then editing those in Vim. It opens every file found in Vim and greps to find the text without quotes in the text. In Vim, use colon bn to hop to the next file and edit as you like. The grep ri looks through every file and directory under the current directory, disregarding the case of the search text, and matches all files. I'm in bash, so it may work differently in other shells. To which Dave Morris replies,
I said I'd skip the orc part here, which is very bad given this is an orc show, but my solution would be Vim, and I quite like using the dollar bracket format because it's more flexible than the back tick one. So dollar open parenthesis.
Because you can nest them, can't you, Dave?
You can indeed. Grep space minus RIL space, and then in quotes, TPL underscore header or whatever else you're doing, space asterisk close parenthesis. So the minus L option is to grep
lines.
No, there.
File names.
I put an E's in there that wasn't there. The minus L option to grep just returns the file name where a match occurred. So there's no need to use awk to separate it out from what grep returns. Because if you didn't do that, you'd get the line as well as the file name. And that's what the awk was doing. It was pulling just the file name out. So grep will do it for you already. In my case, I usually keep Vim backup files in the same directory, so I change the asterisk to asterisk square brackets circumflex tilde close square brackets, and that strange expression will omit the backups because they end with a tilde. So all files which don't have a tilde at the end is what that will do. And as an aside, I prefer the dollar parentheses to backtick since they're more visible and I think nest better. There are times when grep is unnecessary because awk can do the same job, but this isn't one, quite the reverse.
There's another advantage to using the dash L insofar as it will also just stop at the first and give you the line, so the first match.
That is true, yes.
And both of you are doing Vim grepping there. Actually, the first command, if there's more than one TPL header in a file, probably not, but there could be, then you will get each of those instances with the file named. Whereas with the dash L, you will only get one instance because it's already stopped, which is a nice way of doing it.
That's a very good point. Yes, yes, indeed.
Not that I've suffered from that in the past, speaking from experience. You can also use the in awk, in the print there, before the first quote mark, you can use slash and then TPL header slash space print $1, which is something you taught me about, actually, Dave, if I recall.
You can indeed, yes, yes. You can.
But no doubt you'll get to that.
A pattern.
Tune in for the next exciting episode in GNU awk.
Yes, yes, we will try and cover these things. Yes.
Okay, speaking of people who put me to shame, an interview at the All Code Manchester Bar Camp, an interview with Josh, and he's been busy since our last interview. I was listening to the first interview thinking, this guy, he's young, he's inexperienced. And then you just interview him and he's continued to improve and continued to do more cool stuff. So more power to him. I am of course speaking in jest.
He's a very impressive young fella. He's really forging ahead with this Python library he's producing, and it sounds really good. I've not actually looked at it yet, but
pretty good.
Power to him.
Yeah, more power to them, exactly. Keep up the good work, that's what I say. Daily notes and to-do list with Markdown. I use Markdown and Git to keep up with what I do. And this would be by Norrist. Norrist?
That's how I say it, yeah.
So first of all, what's wrong with this episode is he's using Markdown. Oh, that's going to hurt. I'm poking them, Dave. I'm poking them.
Yes.
But no, it's actually a good episode. And I was thinking, I really should do this, but I have so many to-do ways of keeping track of what I have to do that I probably need a way of keeping track of all the things that I want to do, to-do lists.
Yeah, I know. I've tried the various getting things done methods and always sort of failed a bit in doing them. I just have lots of lists of bits of paper. But the journaling aspects of it is very good. The to-do, I don't know, I'm just not, I don't work that way, but the journal stuff is fantastic. I love that.
And I do, I'm joking about the markup thing for stuff like this. I actually would recommend markup. I was thinking after listening to this episode, the way you do, or at least I do, I was thinking, they shouldn't actually be teaching word processing. in schools. They should, here's some word processing. Now we're going to stop using that and we're actually going to do markup so that, you know, you can understand the difference between having a small amount of structure in your text and then using the, you know, converting that in and into rendering, making it focusing on the writing as opposed to spending the 14 hours, formatting the case and changing the line spacing and all that good stuff.
Yeah. I agree. I come from the era before word processors, so I prefer the plain text, which you can then convert into something more usable.
And I actually, I have been thinking about using this for two reasons. One is the A-spell, which I completely agree with. As you know, Dave, I need constantly. I haven't used it, but it actually seems like a good idea to use that on the command line. And the second thing is tracking.
I think that's what, sorry to interrupt.
No, fire ahead,
but, it's if you use Vim as your editor, then you can turn on spell, and I think it defaults to a spell actually. Certainly it uses one of the standard spelling packages that's available on your system, and a spell is usually the one. So you get things highlighted as you spell that wrong, and it also notes grammar, certain number of grammar things, and then you can hover in a GUI interface to Vim. You can hover over a word which has been red underlined, and get a right mouse click will bring you up a list of potential corrections, which is all A-spell, I believe.
Interesting. And the other thing is that tracking walk-ups is actually the thing that kills me in work. The number of people that just end up on my desk, and I don't track that as much as I should.
Yeah, I know. I worked in an environment where we had a help desk, and the help desk would forward things. But then I used to leave my office door open. I had my own office, and just because I wanted to be a friendly manager. And of course, everybody in the department would then walk in and say, "Hey, Dave, if you experienced this, do you know how to fix this?" I've got loads of colleague walk-ins all the time, which I didn't mind, but it's hard to hide away.
Yeah, sure enough. Be Easy says, love this idea. Thanks for the show. I agree with the reasons for using Markdown.
I don't.
It gets out of the way so you can write. No, that's true. It does. I also find the idea of using Git quite interesting, but I would be concerned about privacy. I guess you can host your own in GitLab. Can't wait for my next show. Well, you don't actually need GitLab at all. You just set up a repository on your own server, SSH into it, a remote Raspberry Pi at home, and just that's what I do.
Yeah, me too. I've got my Pi 3 is my Git repository,
which is backed up, no doubt. Blah 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 blah.
It's got an SSD on it, and yeah, it gets
what
backed
could
up
possibly go wrong?
Yeah, SSDs last forever, don't they?
So, do you want to read Finn's reply?
Yes, I will. Nice license, nice show, sweet script. Is it up on a public Git repo somewhere? TLDR, would you mind it? Would you mind?
Too long, didn't read.
Yes, I know. I never know whether you're supposed to. It's too long to read that out, so I just did the mnemonic. Would you mind adding a license? You might think of it as just a little personal convenience script that doesn't mean much, but anyone can adapt if they please, right? But technically speaking, you've got the copyright by default, and I can't legally use this code. You may consider it open source by being on a web page that's covered by the CC by SA license, but they advise against its use for software as it doesn't explicitly cover distribution of source code. See, and there's a FAQ on the Creative Commons site, which I won't read out. I ask you to consider adding a license to make it clear what people can do with your script. I'd sure love to use it, but if I make changes and want to share it, we're in a gray area, which is an excellent point. And I am just, I'm as wicked. I'm as bad at doing this, have been anyway, in the past. So,
maybe we should do a thing where any code uploaded automatically gets a license by HPR. But
that would be
also
interesting.
There is a question here. Okay, they Norris says the copyright notice feedback. Here's a link with the script with the ISC license header in there, so that's sorted. However, not everything's copyrighted automatically. Yes, it is, but if it's not, if it's trivial, I'm not saying this is trivial, but for quite a few of the scripts that I've written, they would be considered trivial, and that was proven in the at least in the first round of the Java case, where you wrote an interface. There's only so many ways of writing something, so if you write it, then yeah, then it's written. It's, you know, you make a lock file, okay, fine. You make a daily file, so that's fine. You run a spell checker, so there's only a certain number of ways of writing that. So yes, copyright means that there's some element of creative work involved, so I would push back on that. Which is criticizing Norris's script, but that is not the intention. It's, I'm just trying to highlight the fact that we are ascribing the tendency not to ascribe copyright to bash scripts is probably okay because they're so obvious, if you know what I mean.
On the other hand, though, there probably is a good argument for sort of keeping a repository of these types of things. I say that because that's what I do now, and I have a Git repository where I just drop all my HPR related scripts, you know, the sort of throwaway things that I would write, and they're all covered by the license I used when I set it up. So I think there's probably something to be said for that, don't you?
Yeah, no, I personally, when I publish anything, it's I put the license in, and usually if it's a script like this, I just put it as public domain CC0, whatever. Yeah. Because but there you go. Yeah, cool. Okay, fine. Following day, Cards Against Humanity, Tlatu, and I think this actually in the circles in which we operate is the one that has triggered lots of people to get into these tabletop card gaming things.
It's certainly the one that's probably most widely known, isn't it?
So, yes.
Because even I've heard of it, so it must be so.
And Spaceman says, lulz, I didn't know it was Creative Commons. The game is a joke in terms of shocking humor, I guess. 4chan/B destroyed my humanity. Before destroyed my humanity, okay?
Yes, yes.
Well, I think the fact that it was Creative Commons gave it a lot of publicity in the community as such.
Windigo says, bees. I've had many fun games of Cards Against Humanity since my partner introduced it to me. I see it as a little bit of a social litmus test, a quick way to judge the humor of people in a group. This tabletop gaming series has been fantastic. Thanks for all of the work put in.
Agreed. Couldn't agree with you more. Tlatu tends to come out with some interesting topics.
Yeah, very original stuff. Yeah. Absolutely.
Glass Cutting Bottles by Operator. And he just went and basically cut a bottle and showed us the Diamond Tech Craft G2 bottle cutter that he used. Interesting show. Don't know if I've ever have a need to cut bottles.
No, I've known people to get into this sort of thing, to make sort of vases and containers and that sort of thing. There's something... You know, if you're into making and reusing stuff, then the throwing away of a really nicely made bottle, it goes against the grain. You'd think, oh, it'd be nice to make something out of it. So I can fully sympathize with the idea.
Absolutely. My objection or my reason for not doing it is purely lack of any sense of aesthetics on my own aesthetic ability, at least on my own part.
Yeah. I know. I've never done this myself, but I've often looked at bottles and thought, well, it'd be nice to make something out of that.
Okay, following episode, MI Bill talks about finishing up the DSO 138 oscilloscope kit, which he wasn't able to get running in the last episode, but he got a new kit from, you know, the original, built that, and as he was building that, was able to debug the other one, so... Very nice.
Yeah, it's a good follow. I'm glad we heard the end of the story. That was very good. And he put up some great pictures of what he was doing and everything, which I always found completely fascinating to look at. So Yeah, quite a desirable little device, actually, once it's built and put in a case. It's really quite nice.
And he says that the real JYE tech kit, he just played around with the real one, and he's got the splash screen of it booting up, and you can see the splash screen there. It's pretty cool.
Yes, which basically says don't clone this software and run it on a cloned board, I think.
Oh, that'll stop all the cloning board people, I'm sure.
Yeah, I know.
So operator again with goes over the items that he uses in his pen testing bag, which a lot of this was very, very interesting. From the, you know, kind of obvious, get a laptop stand so you're not scrunching over your laptop like a caveman. I thought that was pretty cool, the description there. But some of the other stuff was a lot, quite practical. You wouldn't associate with your least pen testers having a good umbrella, you know.
No, these are all very practical things for all sorts of purposes, aren't they? I was impressed by the Wi-Fi pineapple, what's it called? What's it called? Is it the router bag? which is quite a cool name, actually, isn't it? So, yes, so you can go and hack into Wi-Fi from passing people and so forth.
Custom mode earbud roundups, little keyboard. Now, these are all links, an umbrella, jacket. Sorry, we're browsing at stuff there now, following the links again. So, very nice. The following day, I interviewed Francois with a 50-year-old hacking computer. Did you get a chance to look at the video, Dave?
I haven't looked at the video. No, I'm afraid not. I did listen to the show. I'm very late catching up with things this month. A wonderful, wonderful show. Brilliant interview, by the way. And what a thing to be doing. It's just astonishing. And I learned quite a bit here about rope memory. I didn't realize I did not know anything about this. I had some core memory. I donated it to the archive of the university when I left. Mm-hmm. And that was quite impressive. You know, those were sort of semi-handmade. But the concept of building what's effectively a ROM, as I think you said, like a USB stick, knitting it by threading wires in or out of a core was just astonishing. I had no concept that such a thing existed. Very, very good.
And his setup is just fascinating. Fascinating. A lot of people on the IRC were commenting about it. We had also comments from Michael saying, great interview, very fascinating. Couldn't agree with you more. I don't normally re-listen to my shows. I do myself. And in this one, I was just going, why didn't I ask this? I could just have continued doing that interview for another hour or two. But he is available to come back to us to do more shows.
A fascinating fella. Yeah, yeah. Windigo says, superb interview. I feel like this episode should be playing in the Computer History Museum. It's unbelievable to see how much work it took to get us to space and how far we've come with computing.
And Kevin O'Brien, fantastic interview. Love this interview. It was fantastic to hear it about how he worked at the inner workings of these computers. And yeah, it's just a complete mystery. And if you see the photo of the stuff that he hacked together, quote unquote hacked together, it's just awesome. The video itself of it really going to each of the bits, and you can see them coming up on the oscilloscope, and then over on the other side on a spectrum analyzer, from what it looks like here.
Yeah,
brilliant stuff.
Yeah, it's an impressive looking device too. With a bazillion relays and stuff all over, it looks like. Yeah, absolutely. It got me looking at some of the links there, and reading the Wikipedia page about the Apollo guidance computer is quite worth doing, because it goes into details of the actual CPU architecture and stuff, which was amazingly, very, very lightweight, very few instructions. 3-bit instruction and various other things of that sort. And but it's utterly fascinating when you consider what they could actually do with it. You know, the yeah. fact they've made this also so robust, mechanically robust, and you know, also robust against all manner of other potential problems as they took it to the moon. It's just unbelievable. Amazing. Yeah.
And they had a concept of a verb and a noun for entering a launch time and then how long since or something. So you were able to do a lot of combinations just by punching in the codes. Very, very interesting.
You can actually get the code now, isn't it? That during this year, during the summertime, somebody had put up the... a listing of the assembler code for some of the modules in the Gardens computer. I had a brief look at them because you need to know so much about what the architecture was and everything. Take a lot of study to work out what it's doing, but it's amazing. It's there. It's on GitHub, I think, isn't it?
So the next. And final one was Barcamp Manchester Part 2. And Tony interviewed Claire Dodd, who was the organizer, and Damien from Layer Shift Hosting, one of the sponsors.
Yeah, it sounds quite a meeting, just this Barcamp. It's a bit far to go to one of these.
Far to go, Dave.
It's a long way.
For you, it's quite far. It's only that far on the map. But yeah.
Right,
actually, you know, cost wise, I'm probably closer than you. So, yeah.
Yeah, you probably fly to Manchester. You'd fly to Manchester cheaper than you could get to Liverpool and places like that, probably, couldn't you?
Yeah, there's something wrong with the world when that's the case. But yeah, anyways, shall we go over the comments that were outside of the pool?
Yes. So there are 10 comments on 7 previous shows. And the first one was, as usual, I have not lined these up properly.
I have, Dave. I have. So I'll do the first one. It was related to my podcast list by Jane Duck, the podcast that I listen to. And the comment was, just subscribed to Rejoice. Thank you. By El Muslo. And that's something that I was tempted to do myself. So put that on my list. But I have to put all of these into a OPML file anyway at some point. That's on my list as well.
Yeah, I know.
So the experience with a neighborhood cat, and this was a show by Brian where he describes the passing of one of the cats in the neighborhood by another Frank. Touching. I usually listen to podcasts late in bed, basically to relax the eyes and eventually fall asleep. This one almost brought a tear to my eye when your tale came to the point of departure. I grew up with quite some cats, and from those, 2 actually grew old in our household, and the last one was blind for her last year and a half to 2 years. She was mostly outside, mind you, poor thing. Cats can be very sociable. They feel when you're ill, and there's even been stories of a retirement home cat in England that sensed when a person was dying. Then it went into the room, sat on the bed, and spent cozy company until it was all over. So nice comment there. Thank you. Are you caught up, Dave?
I am, yes. The Dark Cults. And it was a comment by RTSN again, I think.
It was before that, actually. It was Klaatu's comment on to Joe. Was it? Yeah.
Yeah. I got too many windows here.
I'll do Klaatu's comment. You can do the.
Yep.
So the show itself was about the Dark Cult's tabletop game. Was that not a no? And Joe had said, Joe had made a comment that they were like yesterday's history and I think like 18 Musics, they're going to return. Klaatu, who had done the show, says, "Thanks, Joe. I wish I had a high moral ground. I could claim that I've always supported analog gaming, but the truth is I'm only discovering it myself. So up until now, I reckon I've been part of the problem. That said, it really does seem like we're more or less in the golden age of tabletop gaming. Granted, the RPG systems from and since the 80s have always been ahead of their time, but it feels to me like the board game and card game systems that have been popping up are truly clever, stepping in equal parts solid game theory and imagination, and they have now something for everyone. If ever there's been a time to get into analog gaming, I think it's right now," in capitals.
That's interesting. I hadn't quite absorbed that comment before. That's very similar to what we were speculating on about the state of tabletop games, yeah. Isn't it? Which is interesting. So anyway, RTSN says, exclamation mark, "Good stuff. To be honest, I was stupid enough to think that I was too cool for RPGs and tabletop games when I was young. So I never got into them back then, and this is something I've regretted ever since. Dark Occults sounds pretty interesting. I think I'll look into it. Thanks for a great episode."
Okay, and the next comment was on my mobile recording solution, which was done by Alpha 32, which had a record decent audio in my Creeper Van, which Alpha 32 says, because we had commented about that, what a Creeper Van was. And he says, "Creeper Van is the name I gave my work van. It's a windowless, black in the back, white van. It's not very glamorous, but it holds a lot of computer parts." So it's your basic white van, I guess.
Yes, yes. I'm glad that was translated. I'm not sure whether it's a Britain versus USA terminology thing or quite what it was, but glad to have that.
So the next one was a comment by Kendall, who said cool to the Alpha 32 episode, how he got an old tablet from the LG G Pad 7. This is one where he got it for a dollar and struggled to put on a new flash on it. So yes, I agree with that comment entirely. And then Tabletop Gaming, John had commented last month on takes time to play a good analog game. And Klaatu replies to his comment going, "There's something comforting and sublimely satisfying about sitting down with a good game and a good cup of coffee and wading through the different rules and exceptions to the rules. It must be a similar to the thrill that a lawyer gets when going to a legal library, or less repulsively when a programmer reviews an API. Lawyers don't have to be repulsive. We all love Karen."
Yes, yes, yes. So the last one, my problem is I've got two tabs.
And you're forgetting to put the press to talk button as well.
I just lost the push to talk button, yeah. These are all comments on the episode about pushing to two Git repositories at once, and which was the I figured was Clacky. Is that the first one in this batch?
Yep.
Yes. Clacky, yes, right. It was. Yeah.
And the show was from Klaatu last month.
Yes. Yes. And do you want to do that one, and I'll do the next?
Okay. Clacky, I figured. Smiley face. I thought, hey, this is probably useful if you want to host something in GitLab and have an unofficial clone at 1 minute later. Yep.
And then he followed up with explicit push. Very cool discovery. I never even considered the idea that you could have several URLs for a remote. As you mentioned, that this kind of mixed remote would make it impossible without adding remotes to push to only one of the URLs. I thought I should mention something that probably not everyone knows. You don't need to set up a remote to fetch or push. You can use an explicit URL instead of a remote name. So git push and then a URL SSH blah 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 head colon master. In fact, because I forget what the various options are for managing references and branches, I often use this to remove a reference in the local repository. So it does git push dot colon ref slash head slash whatever branch.
And then Plutu replies, explicit push. Funny you should mention the explicit push. I knew about it, or at least I knew about explicit push because I use it when migrating Git repositories at work, but only with local URLs. Never dawned on me that it could be done with non-local URIs. Thanks for the tip. To which you replied,
well, strictly, I shouldn't be saying this because it's I replied in November, which is in the wrong list. I will. I said, because I listened to this and thought, yeah, great, but why? What? Who would ever want to use this? I probably even said it when we reviewed the show. And I wrote, thought I'd never use this. This was interesting, but I thought I'd never use it. However, I had an incident recently where making a GitHub copy of a repository on a GitLab instance was desirable. It was straightforward to set up and worked flawlessly. Thanks for explaining the process.
I'm thinking Git is very complex. That's what I'm thinking.
It is, yes.
And an entire series wouldn't be out the window either now that we're getting used to people doing fully fledged entire series. So somebody wants to step up to the old plate, that would be awesome.
Yes, it is hard. I started learning Git by taking the Git manual away and trying to read it. That was a mistake. It's hard work. It's really hard work. And I didn't really learn much from it. You just need to have a problem and try and solve it. I found that sometimes other people have the same thing and share what they did, which is brilliant.
So there was a, mosey over to the mailing list, and there was an announcement that the Ohio Linux Fest was on, and we'll be talking more about that next month. Then I had a question to see how on the community is discussed. We often get asked how popular the community is and a way to calculate that. So the discussion basically continued with Dossman, Hunky Magoo, and Clinton Roy giving feedback. But it basically breaks down to, was more of the question from my point of view, was how do I measure that based on download Apache download logs that we have?
Yes.
To which I haven't actually gotten, I haven't got time to look at that as such yet, but I do plan to. But I also haven't got enough things that people want to know. So people need to tell me, if I had the log files, what would I like to know?
Yeah, difficult one, I guess. Unless you know what you could have.
It's an Apache log. The Apache log with the Apache log stats. So there's a date, an IP address, a URL that they went to, and the user agent. So that's the stuff that we have. We don't have it from the beginning of time, and there are major gaps in it, but that's the stuff that we have. So what should I be looking for in those files? What would be of interest to people to know?
It's questions like how many unique downloads per day or something like that, isn't it?
Yeah.
Those are the sort of questions. And there are tools that will do the uniqueification for you as well.
That's not the question. That's how I do it is fine. But what I want to know is, like, people asking questions so then I can ask, okay, so as you said, unique downloads. Do I then consider, what do I consider as a unique download? Do I consider every request? So if somebody's fast forwarding through the file, do I consider that each one unique download or what? Or do I do all of these permutations and let people decide? So that's the sort of questions that I'd like to know. Or maybe I should just, because I do want to do a show on this. And it would be nice to get a bunch of questions from people, what they would consider to be useful information to extract from that. Or better yet, would be somebody find a way that I can sanitize log files so it would be impossible to derive people's personal information from. But that would also be impossible because people can do that. So that would be a privacy issue.
Yes. Complicated.
Yeah, exactly. So Martin the Bishop sent in some questions about multi-file extras, and you can always do that. That sort of question we normally tend to get on the admin mailing list, which is why I don't actually check to see if it's going to the HPR mailing list. So normally I would just keep that sort of stuff out of the admin mailing list. But because the admin mailing list appears not to be working, I think people have been falling back to the general mail list.
On the other hand, it's, I thought it might be quite useful for people who maybe haven't included other things with their shows, who might want to, that discussion might be something that might be useful to a few people.
Yeah, so it is possible to, how we have tended to do it in the past is you can upload a your show notes, and then if you put multiple images in it, you're not restricted when you upload your audio file. You can upload multiple things at the same time, including a gzip file. So there's several different ways of approaching it, but let's break it down to the two most common. That if you just have a small, you know, email-y type size, I guess, of show notes, but you want to include a few images, what we tend to do is just rename the image as HPR episode, you know, 9999.jpg or HPR 9999_picture1.jpg or whatever. And then you can include references to those in your show notes, because they will be served from hackerpublicradio.com/EPS/HPR999.jpg. What we will do, if it's more complicated than that and you want to include more stuff, you then just create a subdirectory on your home dir, put HPR9999, call the directory that, and put an index.html file in there, and you can reference any files however you wish instead of that. And Dave, I believe you have a tool that will assist people in doing this.
Well, yes, I have a tool that I use to do this. I'm not sure how shareable it is, though it is available on GitLab, I think, is where I put it. But I did do an answer to this where I showed a bit of a make file where I actually use a tar command to generate the zip file. I use bzip, actually. And yep. I use the xform argument to tar, which allows you to chop out the paths. So what you get at the other end is not my paths, the full paths that I have at this end, but is sort of a chopped down, tidied up path to do the end result. So, but
yep,
yeah,
cool.
That's one. It's a small contribution to the discussion. I don't know how many people want to do that.
And also there was, we were talking about how to make the upload form easier, because some people are missing. People always seem to get the clean and, the iTunes tag with explicit or clean tag, but they don't get the intro and outro tag for some reason. And that actually causes a lot of issues for us, because if we encode it and we add the intro and outro, then you get double intro and outros. So I end up having to download the files anyway and checking to make sure. And I kind of know that this host always tends to do their intro and outro, but they've marked that there's no intro and outro. So I better double check that. And sometimes that holds up things because... So Dave rightly pointed out that the website could do it some more explicit way of signaling that. So I'm not sure. If people have improvements, then feel free to send them our way. That shut them up.
I was just waiting for the fusillade of fireworks to stop. Can you hear them?
Nope. Oh, yeah, I kind of can now.
Yeah, it's not cool. That loud. I live on the outskirts of the city, so there's not many people around. So there's work that could be done to make the process a little bit more clear, I suppose. And like, yep. I said to you, I'm not very good with forms. I look at a form and sort of panic and run away. So if you could take away the need to panic.
Yeah, that would be good. Don't panic at the beginning of the day. Also, the CSS needs a little bit of work as well. It's not 100%. The line at the top on the website seems to not be working. I don't know what I did to break that. But anyway, so I don't have anything else. Dave, do you have anything else?
No, I don't have anything else. No, I must remember to press that damn button. sorry about that. I think we've covered everything this time. There's nothing else.
Cool. Folks, keep sending in the shows. We're doing pretty okay. I'm a bit worried. There's still a lot of... I'd like to see people contribute shows out further so that you pick a week that's empty so that we can start filling out those empty weeks. And then that leaves nice little spaces of one or two free slots coming in so people don't have to wait that long. But I don't have cardiac arrest every time I look at this show. So, cool. Anything cool planned for this month, Dave?
I'm trying to make some hardware things. So I got a Blink Stick Pro, which I bought about 2 years ago now, to finally solder. Now I've got a fancy new soldering station. Finally soldered this thing. It only took about 10 minutes. Must be the new soldering iron, that was why. Yep. I want to play with that, make it light up all sorts of fancy things. So.
With my newfound soldering skills, I have two Philips sets of headphones, over ear ones. They're actually quite reliable. And if anyone's seen me interviewing people, they're the ones I tend to wear because they block out a lot of noise. And it just went bust. And then I realized that I had brought a spare soldering iron to work, and I found some solder, and I just soldered the thing up in the middle of work. And I was so chuffed with myself. The thing just worked. Put it back together. Yeah, there you go. Job done. Well done.
Absolutely. That's the way it should be, isn't it?
Soldering is not that hard. I don't know why I've been phobia or just a mental block against doing it. It's just, try it. I suppose if you're doing detailed circuits and stuff, but if you're just hacking stuff together, just hack stuff together, just do it. What's the worst that can go wrong?
You can practice. When I was younger, I used to make little gadgets and stuff out of bits of copper wire. You just get an old bit of mains flex and cut out all the individual strands, then you can bend them into interesting shapes and make things out of them. I made my mum a device which she could fit underneath the worktop and put a gas lighter in. It just sort of slid into a sort of little sort of skeleton framework type thing made out of copper wire. So, and you can have a lot of fun making that sort of thing. If you're into sculpture or anything like that, it'd be a great way to make the skeleton of a model as well. That's what my daughter's into sometimes. So soldering can be used for all sorts of things. It's a lot of fun.
Cool. Okay, tune in next week, next month. Tune in tomorrow, in actual fact, for another exciting episode of Hacker
Public
Radio.
Hooray.
Join us now and share the software. You'll be free. Hacker, you'll be free. Don't know what I was going for there.
It's like a monastic chant almost.
No, I thought I already did one of them. Supposed to do Country of Western or something this time. But if you have a request for what version I should do, then give me a shout. All right, thanks, Dave. Talk to you later. Bye.
Okay, cheers now.
You've been listening to Hacker Public Radio at hackerpublicradio.org. We are a community podcast network that releases shows every weekday, Monday through Friday. Today's show, like all our shows, was contributed by an HBR listener like yourself. If you ever thought of recording a podcast, then click on our contribute link to find out how easy it really is. Hacker Public Radio was founded by the Digital Dog Pound and the Infonomicon Computer Club and is part of the binary revolution at binrev.com. If you have comments on today's show, please email the host directly, leave a comment on the website, or record a follow-up episode yourself. Unless otherwise stated, today's show is released under a Creative Commons Attribution ShareAlike 3.0 license.